I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Belief and fact do not always line up. An Emory University class dives into the convoluted world of conspiracy theories and how they actually influence American politics. This is a part of our occasional series, Lessons from Left Field, in which we look into unusual classes held around the state. So joining me now is Emory instructor Felix Harcourt. Hi there, Felix.
Hi.
Also here are two students, Laura Marquez. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
And Carolyn Conkey.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to have all of you here. Felix, what classifies as a conspiracy theory? How do you separate a conspiracy theory from an actual question that might be credible and put in the Washington Post?
It's an excellent question. It's one that we actually spend considerable time in the class discussing how to define what a conspiracy theory is and how to define who a conspiracy theorist is. And at its heart, a conspiracy theory is any conspiracy for which evidence cannot be shown. Where that then extends out to becomes, I think the word you used before was convoluted, and that's an excellent word to use with regard to these ideas.
Well, one person most Americans recognize as a conspiracy theorist is talk radio show host Alex Jones. He's spread a number of conspiracy theories. For example, he believes 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by the U.S. government.
When we question official stories where the system has the motive, the means, it basically stands to gain, that is patriotic thing to do. Because if you're not aware of false flags, self-inflicted wounds, staged terror attacks, then you invite the system to do this.
So, Felix, how do you then approach some of these ones that most people just sort of dismiss them out of hand? Alex Jones, for example, says he has evidence that 9/11 was an inside job. So you're raising your eyebrows, but that's what he says. So how do you approach that?
Really what the class is about is to be able to take these things, these ideas that it is easy to marginalize, it is easy to mock, because they are so far outside of our kind of understanding of the reality of the situation, and to consider them within their historical context, their social, their cultural context, to confront and dismantle them and to figure out where are these ideas coming from? Why are they being put forward? What situates them within our current society? And to what extent can we understand them as part of this long history of American conspiracism? And particularly to look at the kind of tropes and cliches that conspiracy theorists tend to use to try to put those ideas over. The idea that we tend to refer to in the class as the symbolism of evidentiary rigor. Right? There's not actual evidence, but it seems as though there is evidence.
Before we get to our students here, let's actually hear some people that we spoke to on the streets of Atlanta. We asked them if there were any conspiracy theories that they believe in.
9/11, I do believe, was something they're trying to keep secret. They're not giving out the full story, which leaves a lot of people on the fence and skeptical about, was it real?
I definitely believe in Illuminati. I feel like it's something weird going on with all the powerful people.
I have concerns about whether or not the government controls the weather. The weather is like just so bipolar. One minute it's warm, one minute it's cold.
Okay. So, Laura, let's start with you. Did you believe any conspiracy? Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
No. I came into the class feeling very skeptical of conspiracy theories. I think my instinct when hearing about them is just kind of thinking that they are, you know, people who believe in them are kind of nutty or, you know, just believing in falsehoods. Yeah, so I was definitely very skeptical.
Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
I actually do. Going into the class, I was in very much the same place, thinking conspiracy theories are just things that crazy people say. I think what I've really learned is that, well, I don't necessarily agree with how far conspiracy theories tend to take it. A lot of times there's a little bit of an element of truth. You don't make a conspiracy about a thing where everyone knows all of the facts. So there's usually some element, not what the conspiracists say there is, but there's something with what the government did that triggered this idea of conspiracism in that context.
All right. I want to play a clip referring to one of the most persistent conspiracy theories ever. This is author David Talbot, who says he believes there were two shooters in JFK's assassination, one of them tied to the CIA.
No one else had the organizational power to do it and the kind of way of covering it up in the CIA.
And, of course, here's Oliver Stone. He's the filmmaker behind 1991's JFK. He also believes there were two shooters, and here he is speaking to CNN.
I resort always to the basics, like common sense, your own eyes. There is this wonderful document called the Zapruder film that shows you the time frame and shows you what the shots were doing step by step. And we estimate the people in the community, five shots, maybe six. And you show in the kill shot, Kennedy is going back and to the left very clearly. The shot has to come from the front.
So, Felix, I have to imagine you have to spend some time on the JFK assassination, right?
Certainly.
When you come from Oliver Stone, who made a whole movie claiming that they have evidence, then how do you teach your students to sort of sift through what you've already said sounds authentic and credible?
It's a question of putting something like Oliver Stone, putting somebody like Oliver Stone within their historical context and seeing where his ideas come from. And we can track the ideas that Oliver Stone puts forward back to really the immediate aftermath of the assassination. And you start to see the contemporary New Left concerns about government power, about LBJ, about the rising national security state and the war in Vietnam really give birth to consistent conspiracist tropes. And understanding it in that way allows us to kind of dismantle current conspiracist thinking within this broader context.
Laura, were there conspiracy theories that you ended up taking more seriously that you now think differently of? And is one of them the JFK assassination?
Yeah, I think the JFK assassination was very interesting because I don't think I could have imagined how many theories there actually were. And we didn't even cover all of them, but we had a one or two page sheet with just a laundry list of theories, and I couldn't have imagined. So it definitely put some doubt into what I had previously believed, poked some holes into the kind of narrative that has been accepted as the official narrative.
Carolyn, are you ready to reveal which conspiracy theory you had second thoughts about?
So I actually had the same experience as Oliver Stone. We watched the Zapruder film in class, and seeing that, reading how people had analyzed, I was like, this doesn't quite add up. And obviously, I'm not a forensic scientist, so I can't actually verify that what they are saying is how it's supposed to go is actually how it's supposed to go, but just reading the story doesn't quite make sense to me. So it opened up to me the possibility of not necessarily one of the more out there, like there's two Lee Harvey Oswald kind of conspiracies, but the idea that what the government has told us about the Kennedy assassination isn't quite what actually happened.
So you're not all the way to Oliver Stone?
Not quite, but on the same path.
Ready. Okay, let's hear from journalist David Aronovich. One of his missions is to debunk conspiracy theories. He wrote a book called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Here he is speaking to NPR in 2010.
The thing about dealing with conspiracy theories is you can't just assume right from the beginning that any conspiracy theory is automatically wrong because it seems to violate common sense. I mean, you're absolutely right. You have to go back to first principles and say, what is the evidence for this?
But one of the claims that he makes is that conspiracy theories, even when they're completely outlandish, actually have a huge impact on culture. And that sounds like something that you say in your class as well. How does that add up? For example, the conspiracy theories that we didn't land on the moon. How do things like that actually shape politics and culture?
It's a good question. In large part, especially as we move through the kind of the later 20th century and especially post-Watergate, what conspiracy theories really do is help fuel growing distrust of the government as a body. And you see this almost feedback loop created where real conspiracies are revealed, right? The CIA did engage in something like MK Ultra. Nixon was behind the break-in at the Watergate Hotel.
There actually was a Soviet spy in Congress during the whole Red Scare, for example. That turned out to be true.
And as these ideas come out, as they're released, they give greater fuel to the idea that there are even bigger secrets hiding. And so you see this growing snowball of distrust. And that distrust gets almost weaponized politically. It's a very, very useful tool to galvanize voters.
So then let's hear about a very recent conspiracy theory. This is President Trump tweeted that he'd been wiretapped by former President Obama. Federal investigators, I want to emphasize, no one has found any evidence of this at all. But Trump revealed that he got this from a Fox News pundit.
We said nothing. All we did was quote a certain very talented legal mind who was the one responsible for saying that on television. I didn't make an opinion on it. That was a statement made by a very talented lawyer on Fox. And so you shouldn't be talking to me. You should be talking to Fox.
So, Laura, what do you take away from this? Learning more about conspiracies, has it changed the way you consume news headlines?
Yeah, and I think especially in today's era, we're nearing this phase where we're not really agreeing on anything. So people have two different sets of the truth, and neither one accepts the others. And that is something very prevalent in conspiracy theory. So I think it's definitely, I'm seeing it more and more, and conspiracy theories being propagated. It's definitely more prevalent in my life.
We have a tweet from Melanie Harper who says, I can believe in business conspiracies like nicotine spiking easier than government conspiracies. Greed is a permanent motive. Let's hear about another relatively recent conspiracy theory, again involving Donald Trump. He joined the birther movement, which he questioned whether President Obama was born in the U.S. He told NBC News in 2011 that he just wanted to see the birth certificate.
If he doesn't, it's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics and in the history period. You are not allowed to be a president if you're not born in this country. He may not have been born in this country. And I'll tell you what, 3 weeks ago, I thought he was born in this country. Right now, I have some real doubts.
There's no doubt. Let me just emphasize that is not true. President Obama was born in the United States. But Carolyn, if you give more credibility to some conspiracy theories than you did to others, how do you go about doing that? If you see a news headline come up, what process do you go through to judge its truthiness?
I think a lot of it goes back to just evaluating the evidence kind of for yourself. I think, especially if we're looking at how President Trump tweets out some of these conspiracies, he just asserts it without any of the evidence actually being there. And it's really hard to evaluate whether or not there's any truthiness to that statement without looking at the evidence yourself. And I think that was a lot of what kind of changed my beliefs in this class, was looking not just at what the conspiracists said, but what actually happened and the facts that were behind that. And I think when you look into what they claim supports your evidence, you can really see whether or not they're making some kind of crazy leap or there is some kernel of truth that you can keep investigating more.
Okay, in light of that, you guys all had to create your own conspiracy theory, right?
Yes.
So Carolyn, what was yours?
So my conspiracy theory is that following the Kennedy assassination, Jackie Kennedy continued to push for water fluoridation, which there's a whole conspiracy
there
helps control our minds, to make the country believe in Camelot so that Kennedy could die a martyr without any of the complications of his presidency and his policies coming out.
Wow, that is a very sophisticated conspiracy theory. Laura, what was yours?
Mine's not as sophisticated. Mine was that Jimmy Carter's peanut farm was actually a money laundering front for the Georgia Mafia, and that kind of helped him elevate to power and get to the White House.
That would be an interesting movie.
Yeah.
Felix, why do you have them create their own conspiracy theories?
I think it's the best concrete example of the way in which these theories get created, and to have to do so yourself is a really good inoculation, to use a word that anti-vaccination conspiracy theorists might not be a fan of, but it's a good inoculation against this kind of pseudo-historical thinking that fuels an awful lot of conspiracy theory.
Like the Illuminati. You're trying to prevent your students from being fooled.
Yes, exactly.
So, Laura, what makes a good conspiracy theory? What makes one successful and another not?
I think primarily it has to be convincing. And a lot of what we've seen over the course of the semester is that conspiracists include a wide variety of sources and cite all these links. And our professor has definitely made sure to emphasize that we should have footnotes because in crafting these papers, it makes it look more scholarly and like there's a whole bunch of evidence that you're presenting to your audience and your readers.
Carolyn, did you want to add into that what you think makes one conspiracy theory successful?
I think another part of it has to do with kind of the political movement that's behind it. Some of the most successful conspiracy theories we've been learning about were kind of taken over by some kind of political movement and moved into the mainstream. And I think when there's that kind of partisan belief pushing behind it, that helps make it a lot more convincing because people have a reason to believe in it. It's not just random distrust of the government. It's distrust of the government to get my policy agenda pushed forward.
So, Felix, most of the people listening are never going to take your class. But what advice would you give people sifting through their Twitter and Facebook feed on how to inoculate themselves against conspiracy theories?
I think Laura made a good point in bringing up footnotes. Right? Conspiracy theorists love footnotes. They love the symbolism of evidence. And I would say always click through the evidence to see what it is that they're actually citing in support of their ideas, to see whether or not it does in fact support that case.
Right, like the long debunked study that supports the anti-vaccine movement, which has been debunked over and over and over again. They may be citing that.
Right.
That is Emory University instructor Felix Harcourt. We also spoke with two of his students, Laura Marquez and Carolyn Conkey. We're talking about a class Felix teaches, which is about conspiracy theories. This conversation is part of our series, Lessons from Left Field. And I want to say thank you to Felix and Laura and Carolyn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we always love to get your comments. If you have a conspiracy theory you want to float by us, we want to hear it. You can email us the details on secondthought@gpb.org. Just call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.